From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from around Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. We spoke with him via Skype late Monday. Okay, so we have a lot of ground to cover this week. Let's start with Cuba's president returning from Asia.
I think that's a very significant visit by Díaz-Canel, not just in terms of Cuba, but in terms of the broader region, and in particular the ALBA countries. Because Díaz-Canel would normally have participated in the meeting of the ALBA countries' political council, although it's normally only the foreign ministers that take part. It was quite a significant date for, in terms of the relationships between the different ALBA countries. And I wouldn't have been at all surprised that if Díaz-Canel hadn't had those previous commitments, that he'd have turned up in Managua for the meeting of the ALBA Political Council. And the why do I think the two things are related? I think there are several things that were interrelated over the last few days. The fact that Díaz-Canel visited Russia, North Korea, China, Laos, and Vietnam is very very significant, because although I don't see it as just the president of Cuba renewing and consolidating very well established long-term relationships that Cuba has had with those countries, all led by progressive regimes back in the days of the Soviet Union, and all have come to terms with this. What have we had now ever since the end of the Soviet Union? What is it? That's almost 30 years of savage capitalism.
Yeah.
And those countries, Vietnam, Laos, North Korea, China and Russia, have all in their very different ways come to terms with a world that from 1990 onwards was pretty much a unipolar world dominated by the United States and its vassal states in the European Union.
Yeah, and for Cuba and North Korea, it was particularly savage. We're talking the special period, quote-unquote, in Cuba, for example.
Yeah, and all the difficulties to do with famine and the reasons around all that. The isolation of North Korea during that time as well.
Both. I mean, the U.S. thought that all they had to do basically was starve those two countries and then blow on them and they'd fall over after they swung China and Russia, you know, the USSR fell apart.
Right. So that this visit by the president of Cuba, one has to understand that he represents a new generation in terms of Cuba's revolutionary leadership. And so it was really important for him to go as Cuba's head of state and do these state visits to all these long-standing traditional allies of the Cuban Revolution.
Yep.
Because although the Russian Federation, of course, is no longer the Soviet Union, in terms of its foreign policy has actually changed very little from what I can see.
Yeah.
The foreign policy of the Soviet Union. That's quite logical.
Yeah.
Because the situation of the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the West is almost identical to the current situation of the Russian Federation.
Right. There might be. Anyway, they might not have the ideological competition that existed before, if you want to frame it that way, but. You know, the Russian government still maintains sovereignty over the Russian landmass, which, of course, has all these riches and this highly educated population on it that the people who own most of the rest of the world think is theirs. And so that government is, you know, finds itself in the crosshairs of, you know, Western militaries and Western geopolitics and such, just like the Soviet Union did, for exactly those same reasons, pretty much.
Yeah, and whatever the differences that those countries, North Korea, and obviously has its differences with in within that region with China and other countries, and
right.
But and the fundamental thing is that they all believe in defending national sovereignty, a multipolar world, respectful relations between peoples without intervention or interference in internal affairs, all those fundamental principles of international relations, those countries defend very much, right, to the disgust of the ruling Western elites.
Right.
And that was important, but what I'm trying to get across is that it wasn't, Díaz-Canel didn't do that just as the president of Cuba. He also did it very much as a representative of the ALBA countries. And the ALBA, and I was listening to something by a guy called Uriel Sanchez, a Cuban journalist who runs a program called La Pupila Insomne. And he was interviewed on Telesur the other day, and he said something very interesting, which was that whatever one thinks about the current right-wing offensive driven by the United States' desire to recolonize Latin America and the Caribbean, if you look at ALBA now compared to when it happened, when it started back in 2004, when Fidel Castro and President Hugo Chavez Frias decided to initiate what was then the Bolivarian alternative of the Americas, which now the Bolivarian Alliance of our peoples of the Americas. It was just Cuba and Venezuela. And now, after, what is it, almost 15 years of ALBA being in operation, although Honduras joined and was then left as a result of the coup.
Right.
And although Ecuador has retired from it as a result of the betrayal by,
right, yeah,
Lenin Moreno of the,
right,
the ideals of the citizen revolution of Rafael Correa.
Yeah.
And you still have a bloc that is much stronger than it was back in 2004.
Right.
And that,
right,
that I think that fundamental point is well worth bearing in mind when you look at the massive propaganda about, you know, the end of the progressive cycle, all that stuff that people write to kind of,
right,
make it look as though progressive ideas have lost popularity or have lost relevance in some way,
right,
in Latin America and the Caribbean. And so there are lots of things that I want to look at in precisely in relation to that. But the first thing is that when President Díaz-Canel did his tour of North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, China, and Russia, he was not doing it just as the president of Cuba. He was doing it as a representative of the ALBA bloc.
Right.
Although that might not have been explicit, de facto it was the case. And so what he's doing is consolidating relationships that Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela has already done a tremendous amount to develop over the last couple of years as a direct result of U.S. Led sanctions and also sanctions from U.S. vassal states in the European Union. And so one kind of underlying theme to what we're talking about, that what this area that we're looking at, is the way that U.S. sanctions actually are entirely counterproductive because they drive people to find alternatives to the previous system that the U.S. dominated.
I mean, we're seeing evidence of that all over the Díaz-Canel's trip. You know, discussing military cooperation with Russia and China. Okay, Russia and China are now declared strategic partners directly as a result of the U.S. moving against both of them during the Obama administration, simultaneously sanctioning Russia, attempting to mess with its economy, threatening China militarily and economically. They now, you know, see themselves, you know, basically in a forced marriage by circumstances, And, you know, Cuba, of course, you have the whole history of, and even the economic problems that still exist there are a direct consequence of the U.S. sanctions and that again got voted down almost unanimously at the United Nations General Assembly. But that still exists. I mean, these countries have no other choice but to do this because of the U.S. policy towards them.
Right. And so when you look at that, you have Díaz-Canel involved in that very important visit, consolidating longstanding relationships. You have Nicolas Maduro, he's visited both Russia and China this year, as I understand
right.
it. And so he is also involved in consolidating those relationships. And then, this may sound silly, but last week, the president of tiny El Salvador was on a state visit to China.
Right.
And that's relevant in terms of the United States has been trying to wrap El Salvador and Panama over the knuckles for abandoning Taiwan and opting
right.
to open up relations with China. And so now you have the president of a small Central American country, President Soren, opening up relations with China, goes to China for a state visit, and is treated as, you know, a respected. He's not treated like, you know, he wasn't given 5 minutes with the president.
Right.
You know, which is what would happen to him in Washington. Right.
If.
And he although the protocol may be all flummery in many ways, it does signal something. And what it signals in this case is that China takes seriously its avowal that it respects other countries, no matter how big or small they are.
That's right.
And so, President Soren was able to, there were no dramatic announcements, slight increases in support from China. But the important thing is that El Salvador, and the reason it's important in this context that we're talking about, is that El Salvador is kind of a member of ALBA. It's not a full member
right.
of ALBA, but it participates actively in Petrocaribe and other ALBA programs. And so, again, you have a national state, El Salvador, very closely associated with ALBA, going to China and consolidating that relationship with China.
Right.
Now, that's not as high profile a deal as President Díaz-Canel or President Maduro going to visit China or Russia, but it's still an indication that I think of these things in terms of ratchets. So it's another little ratchet down
right.
in the leverage that the United States has in the region.
Yep.
And it can kind of huff and puff as much as it likes. But if you look at we've had this conversation, this theme in our conversation many times.
Absolutely.
The presidents from the region go to Washington, explain their problems to Washington, and Washington tells them, drop dead.
Right.
They go to China, and that's what happened with Manuel Zelaya. Manuel Zelaya went to President Bush back in the days, in the last year, I think, of President Bush's presidency, or was it 2006, something like that? And he asked for assistance with the Honduran economy, and George Bush told him to drop dead, in effect.
Right.
You know, and so where did he then go? He joined ALBA.
Yep.
And that was what triggered the coup. But anyway, in 2009. But anyway, and that's just an example. And President Soren, Salvador Sanchez Soren of El Salvador, has now taken this step. And why has he taken it? Because he gets nothing from the United States. The United States have nothing to offer their partners.
Right.
So, and then that is the importance of the ALBA Political Council meeting in Nicaragua. It took place, Don, on the 42nd anniversary of the death in combat of Comandante Carlos Fonseca Amador, the founder of the Frente Sandinista de the Sandinista National Liberation Front here in Nicaragua. And the fact that they held the meeting on November the 8th was deliberate. They deliberately held it on that date because they wanted to celebrate the Nicaraguan government's defeat of the attempted coup earlier this year between April and July. They wanted to celebrate that. They wanted to affirm all their country's support for the Nicaraguan government. And they wanted to make a very strong statement of regional unity in the face of both United States attempts to recolonize Latin America and the Caribbean, and the advances in countries like Brazil of outright fascism, which you also see in Colombia under Duque, and the destruction of the peace agreement there. Just in case people don't know, the current members of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas are Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Dominica. I'm not sure St. Kitts and Nevis. I'm not sure Santa Lucia. I'm not sure if Santa Lucia is in or out.
St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Venezuela, St. Kitts and Nevis, Nicaragua, Grenada, Dominica, Cuba, Bolivia, Antigua and Barbuda.
Yep. Right. Antigua and Barbuda. And so you have these Caribbean island nations who have benefited greatly both from Petrocaribe and Alba. Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves of St. Vincent and the Grenadines made a very strong speech at the meeting where the public assembly where they were honoring Carlos Fonseca together with the Nicaraguan authorities. And it was very interesting that Ralph Gonsalves reminded everybody that the Garifuna population of Central America, the Garifuna people are a people of West African descent who originally settled in St. Vincent. And when the British decided that they'd like to have St. Vincent for themselves, they committed the usual genocide that they did and drove out the black population of St. Vincent, who settled all along the Atlantic and Caribbean coast of Central America. So you find, and also I think also up in North America too. So you have Garifuna settlements on Honduras's northern coast, down. I think they're in. They have settlements in Belize. They have settlements on Nicaragua's Caribbean coast and also on Costa Rica's Caribbean coast. And it was just interesting that Ralph Gonsalves made the point that the Caribbean and the Central American countries, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, have a common history, and they have a common interest in standing together against efforts to dominate them and subjugate their resources and peoples to the needs of empire. It was just very interesting, right, for Ralph Gonsalves, one of the leaders of the West Indian group of nations that, yeah, in CARICOM, the Caribbean community, that he made that very strong statement as part of the ALBA meeting last week in Nicaragua. And another strong statement was made by Bolivia's foreign minister, who was at that meeting. And that was interesting because also last week, Bolivia held a meeting of UNISUR, right, or the countries that continue to participate in UNISUR. And Bolivia is also taking over from El Salvador, as it happens, the presidency of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is the integration body that was set up really at the initiative of President Hugo Chavez, strongly supported by the Cuban leadership and, of course, by Daniel Ortega and his colleagues in Nicaragua. And so that CELAC is how the acronym is pronounced in Spanish. That body, which excludes the United States and Canada, even despite the current ascendancy in much of Latin America of right-wing governments, that remains extremely relevant because it's the only body that enables Latin America as a region, Latin America and the Caribbean as a region, to negotiate as a bloc with, say, the European Union or the People's Republic of China or the Russian Federation. So it remains extremely relevant despite attempts by individuals like Mauricio Macri and the elites that he represents in Argentina, and we're sure to find something similar happening with Jair Bolsonaro and the Brazilian elites. Perhaps we can talk a bit more about that if we've got time. But the CELAC remains extremely relevant even for the right-wing governments in the region, whereas UNASUR has gone through a crisis as a result of the rejection of its attempts to try and serve as a platform to mediate ideological differences between, in particular, between extreme right-wing regimes like Argentina's and the usurper government of Michel Temer in Brazil, Ivan Duque in Colombia, Sebastian Piñera in Chile. And these right-wing governments, they don't like the fact that the ALBA countries in UNASUR, in specifically Venezuela and Bolivia, are able to use UNASUR as a platform whereby they're able to demand that they be treated as equals with respect. The right-wing governments in the region much prefer to serve as the lackeys of the United States in the Organization of American States and follow the U.S. agenda in the Organization of American States in political terms. But UNASUR remains relevant on the economic front, in terms of economic integration. And you can see that the importance of the fact that, for example, Peru is not going to abandon UNASUR. Peru is currently going through one of its periodic political crises with the former right-wing opposition leader who almost became president, Keiko Fujimori. She's now been sentenced to 30 months of preventive jail in relation to corruption charges.
Right.
But the government there still has a strong right-wing stance, but in terms of, this goes back to what we're talking about in terms of CELAC, Peru is very interested and very committed to working with Bolivia on regional integration initiatives like the Transcontinental Railroad financed by China. And it's fascinating to see how all these things interact.
This is the brainchild of Hugo Chavez in many ways. He was the one that said, you know, look, we don't need an ideological test to be your partner. You're here in the same region we are. We will defend your sovereignty. We will seek to move closer to you culturally, economically, in whatever ways are beneficial to each of us. And how you run your country is your business, and how we run our countries are. It's like China with their win-win. It's an interesting looking past arguing over ideology towards materialism, really. Towards let's get the actual practical things functioning together and recognize where the real threat comes from and defend ourselves from that, and the rest will shake out.
Right. And you have this internal conflict in UNASUR between the countries of the so-called Pacific Alliance,
right,
which Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico.
Yeah, the TPP
Mexico,
folks, right.
Mexico on the 1st of December will be governed by a president,
right.
Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has taken a lot of criticism from the right wing in Mexico for inviting Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, to his inauguration. But we're jumping away from where I really want to focus on at the moment, which is this the what you were talking about, the economic imperative of who's doing the investment in infrastructure. Well, it's not the United States, right? It's China.
Right.
So the right-wing country, a right-wing country like Peru, whom you'd expect to be more amenable to following what the United States wanted to do, clearly sees that its best interests lie in working with China and whoever the other partners are, because there's a bunch of European engineering companies that are interested in participating in the transcontinental railway project. But there's that happening, but there's also another right-wing government, Paraguay, run by under President Horacio Cartes, who's a really strong right winger, and he may not be as fascist in the terms that Jair Bolsonaro is, who's going to take over the presidency in Brazil shortly, I think also in December. But Horacio Cartes and his administration are extremely right-wing, and they've just collaborated closely again with Bolivia to open up a Bolivia's port system to the Atlantic.
Right.
Now Bolivia, and that happened about a month ago, I think. So Bolivia now has a port system out to the Atlantic for the first time ever, you know?
Right.
And so you have Peru on the one hand collaborating with Bolivia and China on the transcontinental railway. You have Paraguay collaborating with Bolivia on a port system out to the Atlantic, and also Uruguay. One has to be very careful about the assumptions that one makes in terms of what are going to be the practical outcomes of these, of this ideological configuration. Because just the mere fact that you have a right-wing government in Peru and a right-wing government in Paraguay would make you think, oh, well, they're going to ally with Chile and they're going to do what they can to stymie Bolivia's national development under a progressive government. You know, that's what you think, but that's not what has happened. And there are all kinds of reasons for why it hasn't happened, but I don't know enough about to go into in a brief way.
Right.
But the thing about that is that what you had was, look at these five things.
Okay, look at them in a minute and a half, because that's how much time we have left.
The president of Cuba goes to Asia. The ALBA countries hold their meeting in Managua. Bolivia holds a meeting of the UNASUR countries. President of El Salvador goes to China. And the president-elect of Mexico throws off his critics and does what he thinks is the right thing, inviting President Maduro to his inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And all that strongly offsets the depressing result in Brazil.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, the whole narrative of a conservative restoration, or be more counter-revolution, I think would be the proper political language. But all of that, it gives the lie to it, because the forward motion is obviously still there. It's a matter of struggle, because resistance being put up by the old order. But you can see that people are not going home and giving up, that's for sure. All right, so
they've got nowhere else to go but forward.
That's right. All right, so we got to stop there. Tony, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as always. And we'll pick up where we left off next week, starting with what's happened with Cristina, the charges dropped against her in Argentina for lack of evidence.
Hey, look forward to it.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.